Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The Antioch student body was virtually all white. In my class, there were only a few black students, so there was an unspoken expectation that I would date a certain black guy. My Cupid friends had selected a nice young black man to be my date, but I resented their matchmaking. In retrospect, I see that it would have been nice at least to have gone out with him. He was Leon Higginbotham Jr., now deceased, who became one of the first blacks appointed to the federal bench. I chose, however, to date one of the Jewish guys, Walter Rybeck, a fourth-year student from Wheeling, West Virginia, and my piano accompanist. We dated for about 2 years, doing fun things together like bird-watching and attending folk festivals. We became rather serious about each other and discussed marriage, but I wanted a career, and he was concerned about the racial and religious identity of our children. Would they be half-Jewish, half-Christian, half-black, half-white? We were stymied at the thought of the many barriers we would have to cross. We soon had an experience that would answer our nagging questions about whether we could be happy together as an interracial couple. On Tuesday, November 9th, 1948, I made my singing debut at Second Baptist Church in Springfield, Ohio, with Walter as my accompanist. The performance, publicized in several local papers, such as the Xenia Gazette, was well attended with more than 100 people in the audience. Still beaming from our success after the concert, Walter and I attended a folk dancing festival in Wheeling, West Virginia. Walt got out of the car to place a phone call to his parents, asking them to meet us at a certain restaurant in town. When he got back in the car, I had one question. What about me? He paused, searching for words. It had not even dawned on him that I would not be allowed to eat at the restaurant he'd selected. When his parents arrived, we ate somewhere else, but the experience depressed me and marred the weekend. It gave us a powerful glimpse of what an interracial marriage would be like and the challenges we'd face if we stayed together. One of us would be welcome somewhere, the other would not be. One would be associated with what was right with the world, the other with what was wrong. All of it was too much baggage for us to carry, and so we broke up. Bruised from that heartbreak, I distracted myself with my studies, but racism also challenged me in my degree path. I was the first black person to major in elementary education at Antioch, with a minor in voice. In order to meet all the requirements of my major, however, I had to teach for a year in the Antioch Private Elementary School and for a year in the Yellow Springs, Ohio public school system. Because there were no black teachers in the Yellow Springs public school system, I was deprived of my right to teach there. When I took my concern to the supervisor of student teaching, she did not support my right to teach in the local school system. This disappointed me deeply. Instead, she suggested I travel 9 miles from Antioch to teach in a segregated school in Xenia, Ohio. Her rationale was that God did not intend the races to mix. When I took the issue to the president of Antioch, he didn't support me either. Later, I learned that he had a black dog named Nigger.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Sunday, April 30th, 2017. So I have been told. If folks out there, if you are listening live, I think you are about an hour away from National Geographic, said that correctly, National Geographic's fresh new documentary on one of the greatest moments in American history, the 1992 Los Angeles riots, set to debut at 9 p.m. I've still had that in the back of my mind since I found out about that yesterday. National Geographic doing a documentary on rioting in America. Incredible. With that. All you can do is laugh sometimes. You cannot make this stuff up. Mm-hmm. Transitioning from that, we certainly still massive appreciation and still learning immensely from the tremendous work of the late Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, third generation physician, general and child psychiatrist, author of the ISIS papers. She was a guest on this program many, many times, and even some of our listeners were able, thankfully, to go and participate in the memorial service that was held for her last month in March to mark her birthday, just a little over a year after her passing. I wanted to get our guest on the program. She was one of the folks who helped coordinate the event last month for Dr. Welsing and has also been working tirelessly, continuing the Cress Welsing Institute. They meet the second Thursday of every month. It's the same schedule that Dr. Welsing carried out, where her students, they get together and discuss her work, counter-racist suggestions for us to solve the problem, racism, white supremacy. But they are continuing that institute. It'll be meeting next month. That would be in May. I can give you the exact date. So the second Thursday in May is the 11th, May 11th next month. And then they'll meet one more time before the spring break in June. So go support for folks that are in the D.C. area. You can meet, network with other people who are familiar with and appreciate the work of Dr. Welsing and continue to work on the problem. Our guest for today's broadcast, in addition to spending years studying the work of Dr. Welsing, being a close confidant, traveling with her to different lectures and what have you, she's also conducted her own impressive counter-racist research. She has some of the interviews that she's done online. I know the one with Farrah Winfrey. Check that out. I've posted it. I learned a lot from that as well. Always a pleasure to have her on the program. She was with us last year right after the passing of Dr. Welsing to share some of her thoughts, and it's great to have her back with us now, particularly to get some insight on the prediction that Donald Trump would be president. Obviously, Dr. Welsing was correct on that one as well. Pleasure to have her back with us, joining us live, our guest, Miss Sabrina Johnson. Sabrina, you with us?
Absolutely. Yes. Peaceful greetings to you. Thank you so much for all of your work, Brother Gus. It's been tireless. It's been consistent, and we appreciate you're certainly doing a major part of pressing forward with Dr. Welsing's analysis and work and helping people understand what it is that we need to know concerning the context, as you emphasize, with which within which we are existing and what we need to do about it to bring about justice. So thank you so, so much.
Appreciate it, and likewise, you've been doing this work as well. I'm certain some of the folks remember your discussion when you were with us last year, but just any of the folks, I'm sure this is their first time hearing from you. Anything that you think people should know about who you are, the work that you do?
I am classified as a non-white person under the system of racism, white supremacy. I had a lot of questions growing up myself in a small town in South Carolina and had a lot of encounters concerning, quote-unquote, inferiorization, particularly in the classroom by a lot of white teachers. Had the experience of a classmate whose father was lynched. And we're not talking about the 30s or 40s. We're talking about the late 70s. So I had a lot of questions about what this thing about race was and why it was. And because I think of the sincerity of my concern and curiosity and all of the things that I had been exposed to that were enriching to me, that contributed to my own sense of self-worth as an individual and certainly as a Black person, I think all of that prepared me to encounter Dr. Welsing. And once I became familiar with her and her analysis of this global system, I locked into that and just became a devoted student. And so I attended and participated in the Cress Welsing Institute from the time that I was in the Washington, D.C. area until Dr. Welsing's transition. And along the way, we traveled a bit to race relations institutes and other kinds of activities where the discussion entailed racism, white supremacy, and all of its various aspects. And, you know, it just had lots and lots and lots of extensive dialogue in her home and my home and around town as well. So I am so thankful to her and to Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., who influenced her greatly in her understanding of racism, white supremacy as a global system. I am indebted to them because I have some sense of sanity because of them, and I am absolutely committed to carrying forward this work and expanding her legacy, her work, her words, whether it's written or spoken, everything that she stood for, which we see, you know, very, very precise evidence of the accuracy of now. So I'm always happy to connect with those who are similarly committed, as you have certainly demonstrated, Brother Gus. So that's a little bit about who I am and how I came to be connected with Dr. Welsing.
Wow. I'm still learning myself. I had no idea that you grew up some of your formative childhood years in the great state of South Carolina. Wowee. Before, I want to definitely touch on the Trump prediction, because I think that is important. And some of the other things that you touched on in terms of what you're doing specifically to carry on Dr. Welsing's work and her legacy. But I don't want to stray from the introduction. That was not Dr. Welsing that we started the program off with. She's been on this program dozens of times, could have easily picked something from there. I chose that, number one. Many times, Dr. Welsing, I heard her say on this program and any other time she had an opportunity to talk to Black people, she would emphasize reading is more important than watching television.
And watching TV, right.
That audio segment was from the 2017 autobiography of the late Coretta Scott King. We're reading it for our book club. That was something Dr. Welsing encouraged, Black people having book clubs where they can read and get a better understanding of racism. That book is a great example. We're about a little less than halfway through. Lots of great information. That portion where she talks about her experience at Antioch College and dating and some of the things that happened to her, some of the racism, white supremacy she experienced at Antioch College, very interesting. That's one of the early portions of the book. And we read it during the book study session. I asked listeners if anything stood out about that. Nobody really picked out anything. Did anything stand out in that segment in relationship to Dr. Frances Cress Welsing?
Antioch College, Yellow Springs, Ohio. That's where Dr. Welsing did her undergraduate studies as well. And she was the only Black girl in her class. And that's where her awareness began to shift a bit concerning people who classify themselves as white, because Dr. Welsing grew up on the south side of Chicago, very much immersed in Black community, and people who knew who they were and we're in, you know, constant battle to assure that their children had a sense of self-worth and could move forward and be capable of and desiring to use their talents and their skills and whatever resources they were to invest in the upliftment of Black people. Whatever your vocation or job profession was, put your energy towards lifting up Black people. But it was at Antioch College that Dr. Wilson really began to think about the distinctions between people who classify themselves as white and those that they classify as non-white. So that really struck me. So thank you for bringing that forward. And the dog named Nigger, you know, there were a lot of white people apparently who had dogs, who named their dogs Nigger, because I've heard and I know of situations where, you know, that was the case. And it wasn't this particular incident that was being referenced here. So that's interesting. A Black dog, of course, named Nigger.
Of course. Of course. If I was really interested, if I could do it in 15 seconds, I'll play it. But there's a documentary. It's called Trouble Behind, and it's about it's about Kentucky specifically, a specific city in Kentucky where they purged all of the Black residents. This was in the 20th century. Same event, Rosewood, Tulsa, Oklahoma. This has happened more than 250 times, according to one of our guests on the program who looked at census records. But they kicked all the Black people out, and they went back and did a documentary about this some years later, and they talked to a white resident, and he said, "What are you talking about? There was no racism. We didn't do anything bad. Those Black people were just running around and acting crazy." And he says, "As a matter of fact, I had a dog growing up. He was shiny, muscular. I loved that dog. He would, when I called the house, he would just go crazy barking and make sure somebody answered the phone and blah, 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 blah. You know what his name was? Nigger." And he keeps, and then he goes back to the Black people that kicked out. He says, we were not racist. That is a total lie. They were just acting a fool and blah, blah, blah. We love everybody. I love Black people. I love my dog named Nigger. I've heard that many, many times. And the reason that I really wigged out when we were reading the book, Dr. Welsing said the same thing about Antioch College. She said that the president, in fact, she said it on this program, and the only reason that I didn't play that is because she was on this program 31 times, and I cannot pinpoint exactly where she did, but I know for a fact she not only talked about Coretta Scott King being there. Coretta Scott King was there a little bit before Dr. Welsing. She was a little bit older than Dr. Welsing. But she, mm-hmm. President had the dog named Nigger. I mean, she ran down everything. And I said, wow, that is amazing. I was a little bummed because none of our listeners at the time remembered that Dr. Welsing is also an alumnus from Antioch College. But we can forgive that. That's in the program. If you got one from the memorial, it's in there. But they didn't remember the anecdote that she said about the dog being named Nigger either. But I was pretty sure.
Wow.
I was pretty sure you would get it, and I'm going to be on my diligence to pick out exactly where she said that on the program, because she shared a lot about her time at Antioch College and how exactly she just laid out that led to her becoming the scholar and attempted counter-racist activist that she was. Anything else you wanted to add?
That it just reminds me, this dog and nigger named Nigger thing. One of the other students from the Creswell Institute shared this a few years ago. Her husband is in, is a social worker, and he paid a visit to a white family that was, you know, in distress. And there was a young white child, maybe about 5 or 6 years old, and she came to meet the Black male social worker, and she has a dog, and, you know, she introduced herself, and then she introduced the dog. I don't remember the dog's name, but let's just say it was Rex. And the little white girl, the little white child said to the Black male adult, "This is Rex. He doesn't like niggers." I thought that was quite interesting. An interesting introduction.
Wow.
She made things clear right off the bat.
Wow. No confusion. I at least appreciate that. Now we don't have any ambiguity. I will know that I need to stay away from wrecks. Thank you kindly. Won't have any accidents. Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Miss Sabrina Johnson. Before, and I would even connect that because I notice a lot of, I've just seen a trend where white people would name their dogs after black people. I just saw a segment recently. They were talking about naming their dogs either after President Obama or sports athletes, LeBron James, all these folks. I think it's about the same thing. That's just a more sophisticated expression of the same type of behavior, in my opinion. But
absolutely. Just like not saying president in front of Obama. That was, you know, or Obamacare. It's the same thing. Nigger. It's a replacement word for nigger.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With at the beginning, when you were talking about some of your work to make sure that you preserve and continue build on Dr. Welsing's work, her legacy. One of the things, and I laughed, some of our listeners, they were able to attend the memorial service, and they took some photographs, and one of the first pictures I got is the handout that I'm holding in my hand from the service. It's got information about the program, and then at the very top, functional definition of racism. And Dr. Welsing, that was something that she emphasized on a regular basis. I think pretty much any time she got an opportunity to speak to an audience or do an interview, television segment, definition of racism, just really emphasizing that and just trying to make it as clear as she possibly could that you really cannot proceed accurately with a correct understanding, looking at a problem, if you do not have an accurate, functional definition of racism. Can you just, again, emphasize, because that's something that I bump into so many people, black people I'm talking about, and either they don't have a definition of racism and or they just do not understand why it is critically important that you have, even if you don't agree with Dr. Welsing's definition, you got to at least have a definition of racism to get involved in this conversation in an intelligent manner. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. I mean, how could you solve any problem or approach an analysis of anything if you don't first define what it is that you are trying to understand or get more clarity about? What is the thing that you are seeking information about? And sometimes, you know, we don't know fully and thoroughly. But based on what we do know, we do a synthesis and an analysis of what we do know, and we sharpen it over time. So Dr. Welsing, based on her own understanding as a psychiatrist of what happened at the psycho-emotional level, in concert with Mr. Fuller's framework classifying racism or white supremacy as a system, a global behavior system, when you put all of those elements together, she was able to, in a very coherent and cogent format, present the definition. And, you know, in this day and age of slogans and, you know, tweets and everything being superficial and just, you know, too brief and quick, we need something that is thorough and comprehensive. And if you just go word by word, everything makes sense in terms of this functional definition with what we have observed, not in one area, but globally, not in a short period of time, but over hundreds of years. And there are no behaviors that fall outside of this framework because it is so comprehensive, thorough, and accurate. Otherwise, you know, if we're thinking racism is about money, or if we're thinking that, well, they don't know, it's not intentional, those who practice racism, it's only those who are overtly calling names and all of that. Or at the same time, you have all this quote-unquote interracial coupling or sexual intercourse between those who classify themselves as white and those they classify as non-white. At the same time, you have lynching. And then thinking about that dynamic in and of itself, not just kidnapping some person, not just vigilantism, and not just murdering someone, but tampering with, mutilating the genitals of black males. That is a very unique phenomena globally. It is unique to people who classify themselves as white, aggressing against those that they classify as non-white, particularly black males. And then, you know, all the other aspects of that, you know, keeping portions of the black male genitalia as a trophy, that kind of thing. If you just in isolation examine that, it just seems weird, bizarre, crazy, wacky, you know, those kinds of words might come to mind. But within the functional definition, it's explained, and it is absolutely logical. If the focus is on white genetic annihilation, the fear of white genetic annihilation, where does the mind subconsciously and or consciously focus? It's on the area that houses the genetic material, which has the capability of annihilating. So everything, you know, just name something, some kind of an interaction, a behavioral dynamic, and it's very easy to point to where it fits within this functional definition of racism, white supremacy. And I'm so glad that you started with that, because I just want to push and encourage and even implore everyone who is black and other shades of black, other non-white people, to not only read the definition, study it, memorize it, but share it in every forum that you can. So if you're on Facebook or Instagram, or if you tweet, whatever the case may be, post it, send it out in emails. If you send people birthday cards or some kind of greeting cards, holiday cards, get well cards, something, just put a copy of the functional definition of racism, white supremacy, and include that in the card. That's a greater gift than anything monetary or material that you can give a person who you care about. It's an understanding, and it's critical now, especially. This is a very unique window of opportunity that we have now, because of, yes, this president, but all of the very interesting behavioral dynamics that people who classify themselves as white have been carrying forward ever since November, I guess, 5th of 2008. You know, since President Barack Obama ascended into the White House, so to speak. So, get the functional definition out there. Look at it every day. Frame it. Put it in your house. If people come over to visit and they want to, you know, everybody's into selfies these days, get a poster board size of it and take a selfie with that. I was encouraging people to do that at the commemoration. It's critical to our understanding. There's no feat in engineering or science in making things, producing things, generating material things or scientific approaches that are absent a definition of what you're dealing with. So that's critically important. Can't emphasize it enough. And please just get it out there. And by the way, on the item that you mentioned, Gus, at the so there's the functional definition, and it's a paragraph. It's not just sloganized, you know, four or five words. It's a paragraph. It's a thorough definition. And then Dr. Wellesley also made some sort of contextual narrative explanation about the importance of defining something. And that's included underneath the definition. And then at the very bottom of this page, it all is sitting on the foundation of Mr. Fuller's quote, which I consider to be the most profound of all. If you do not understand white supremacy, racism, what it is and how it works, everything else that you understand will only confuse you. So take a photograph of these or email it out. Just get it out to all of the people that you know. Post it in every medium that you can.
Mm. The form that she's talking about, I have it right in front of me. That definition, again, racism, white supremacy, is the local and global power system and dynamic structured and maintained by persons who classify themselves as white, whether consciously or subconsciously determined, which consists of patterns of perception, logic, symbol formation, thought, speech, action, and emotional response as conducted simultaneously in all areas of people activity for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth, a planet upon which the vast and overwhelming majority of people are classified as non-white, black, brown, red, and yellow, by white-skinned people, and all of the non-white people are genetically dominant in terms of skin coloration compared to the genetic recessive white skin people. And she also mentioned, Sabrina Johnson, she also mentioned the paragraph right below it where it says, in the existing system of racism, white supremacy, when the term is undefined and poorly understood, there is general confusion and chaos on the part of the victims of that system, local, national, and global. It then becomes impossible for the victims of racism to effectively counter the global system of racism. Absolutely. And I wanted to ask, because this comes up all the time. I almost laugh a little bit because people present this to me as though this is like novel, as though this is the first time someone has said this. But people will be, they'll say, you know, I really appreciate Mr. Fuller's work, or I really appreciate Dr. Wellesley's work. They've been great. They helped me out a lot, and I've changed a lot of behaviors. The only thing, I don't think we should call this white supremacy. And from there, it'll either go, white people are not supreme, and I'm not going to refer to these savages and racists. I'm not going to refer to them as supreme, referring to them as supreme that puts them above you. And that right there automatically hampers our effort to solve this problem, because you've placed racist man, racist woman, racist child, you've placed them on a pedestal. And so you already are thinking that they're so powerful and omnipotent that they just can't be defeated. We should find a better term. We should find a more accurate term, as opposed to consistently saying white supremacy. They'll say you're almost referring to white people as gods when you call them white supremacists. What's your response to people who say we should move away from the term white supremacy?
The reason why they say that is they're having an emotional reaction to the term white supremacy, and nobody wants to think of someone else as being supreme, especially white people who they, you know, who carry out all of these behaviors that are indeed, you know, wicked, evil, blah, blah, blah. However, it goes back to it proves the criticality, the importance, the how essential a definition is, because Dr. Wellesley is not saying that white people are superior or are supreme. However, they are in the supreme position. And if you want to change something, before you can change it, you have to acknowledge what it is. And as Mr. Fuller often says, compared to the inmate, the warden is supreme. He's in the superior position. He might have a lesser so-called IQ. The warden might not be as strong or intellectually gifted or whatever the case, whatever the metric may be as the inmate. But who is in the superior or the supreme position? We have to acknowledge that. If you don't acknowledge that, then don't complain about anything. There's nothing to change if you can't acknowledge what we're dealing with right now. It doesn't mean that anyone is inherently, quote-unquote, better than. It means in this positioning, in this system, in this framework of behavior that has been structured and maintained for hundreds of years, it means that there is a power ratio. And as it stands now, it's white over non-white. It has nothing to do with someone's inherent, quote-unquote, goodness. And so we have to circle back to the definition.
I have had those conversations, and I will confess that is one of the areas where I probably need to do a better job of being patient in terms of when that critique pops up. But I have been telling people on the program and elsewhere, number one, I don't argue. It's VGQ, Victims Guarantee Qualified. It's United Independent, so it's not like I need consensus or agreement with other victims of racism or even racists. But when that comes up, like people want to have a dialogue about it, I've just said that at this point, I don't know if people have seen the film on the Attica prison uprising. They just had the 45-year anniversary, unless I'm mistaken. But they had a scene in one of the movies about this where it was a black male and he was in the jail cell. Great illustration of racism, white supremacy. He's in the jail cell and they have a white guard, which was pretty much the case. And he's got the book and it's got all the rules and regulations for the prison. And he's saying, Mr. Guard, you are dumb and ignorant and you don't even know the rules to your own prison. Now, according to bylaw, section such and such and such, his toilet was broken. I am guaranteed to have my toilet fixed. And I'm also guaranteed a shower. And it says right here on page 302, and I've got the rule right, and you don't even know it. And he's just on and on. And the white guard outside says, mm-hmm. 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 And he's got his nightstick, and he waits. He says, well, all right. I'll be back later, maybe. And the guy is still in the cell, and he's just yelling and man, you're so dumb. You're so dumb. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'll catch you later. But and he just goes on about it. And I said, that is about the way it sounds when non-white people, when they start saying white people are dumb and ignorant and you don't even know that. Mm-hmm. That might be true. The guard, he actually might be ignorant. He might not, but he still has the keys and you're still in the cell. And that's about all I have to right. say about anything else. About white people being ignorant or stupid or they're not supreme. Until they don't have the keys and or I'm not in this cell, I'm not interested in that conversation at all. It doesn't even make logical sense. And exactly what you said, I think some of that is just the emotion about all of this. I can understand, but we just got to get down to solving problems and not feeling emotional about all this.
Right, right. And I do have, I have cultivated patience over the years. And I understand because when I first began to read the code, Mr. Fuller's book, The United Independent Compensatory Code System Concept, I didn't, like, initially, I kind of thumbed through. And I just happened upon a reference to, you know, white people being the smartest people on the planet. And I'm like, because I was thinking in my definition of smart, and I've been in the classroom with, you know, white students from kindergarten on. So I was thinking of it from, you know, my own sense of definitions and experience. And but then when I explored more of what Mr. Fuller was putting forward, I see what he means, and he's correct. I mean, they have more information about, you know, the reality of what we're dealing with, and are smart in carrying forward what it is that they want to have happen. And it has nothing to do with, quote, my so-called IQ score or anything that is has anything to do with my own personal or constitutional capabilities or anyone else's capacities. It has, it's not that. But, you know, we have to, communication is, it's so, so important. And oftentimes we miscommunicate because we assume that the other person means what we understand is a case, as opposed to something different. And so, you know, it all circles back to understand word by word, as Mr. Fuller would break it down, exactly what you mean by this word you are using right here, right now, so we can have an understanding and then go forward and do what we need to do.
Absolutely. Context of white supremacy. And I really appreciate that when Mr. Fuller emphasizes, what do you mean? Not what is written in this dictionary, not what they come up with. What exactly do you mean when you're saying this term? That way we can get clarity, understanding in this particular conversation. And I think that's extremely important in terms of just accurate understanding of what we're talking about and just being honest about who has power on the planet right now. Unfortunately, and that can change. That's something I try to emphasize. There would be no point to any of this. I know Dr. Welsing would have said that. There would have been no point to me spending all of this time doing the Welsing Institute and doing interviews and writing books and everything and being patient and talking about black self-respect. It would be no point to all of that if this problem could not be solved. Yes, this problem can be solved. White people, unfortunately, are in the position of power right now. That can and will be changed. That's the whole point of all of this, studying Dr. Welsing's work, to change, solve this problem. And again, looking at her work, and I appreciate what you said as well, because I suspect a lot of people, myself included, have been in that position where they have not really closely studied. Like when you were saying, you just kind of flipped through Mr. Fuller's work and just kind of browsing around. I'm sure a lot of us have been in that position where we didn't closely read Dr. Welsing's work or any other scholars that you appreciate that have helped you get understanding. Really important. Dr. Welsing said that all the time. Reading is more important than
watching TV.
Amen. Amen. She said that about every time she came on this program, and she said it, you know, elsewhere as well.
Exactly.
In that vein, I went back and reread the ISIS papers when I was writing about her, I mean, stunningly accurate prediction, more than a year in advance, that Donald J. Trump would be the next president. In the ISIS papers, she has a particular paragraph that stood out a lot where I want to get your thoughts. She writes, "The specific fear of white genetic annihilation, while always present in the global white collective, becomes more prominent and is more frequently acted upon in times when whites have lost a war and or when there is serious economic uncertainty. At these times, the white collective feels insecure because the major proposition for the sense of white invincibility and for fear of white genetic survival, their guns and money, seem to have failed. Thus, after the Germans' loss of World War I, which was followed by political instability, high-level inflation, and high-level unemployment, there appeared on the scene a dynamic spokesperson articulating the need to destroy those perceived as capable of ultimate white destruction. In the United States, we are in such a period." Now, she wrote this in 1980, but whoo! This sounds like she could have wrote this yesterday, April 29th, and been talking about our current president and our situation. Can you talk about the importance, the significance of Dr. Welsing's prediction that Donald J. Trump would be the next president and how that was rooted in her theory of white genetic annihilation?
Right. I mean, again, having a thorough, firmly grounded, deeply rooted understanding of what motivates the behavior, and then observing institutions and interactions over time globally, that makes it very, very easy to predict the next move. For instance, you don't have to be psychic. I could describe an experiment where we have a room with a window and one door, and we put a huge bowl of, in a clear bowl, of M&Ms in the center of it, right? And we send in, let's say, 15 children between the ages of 4 and 8. And we tell them, you can't have any M&Ms until an adult comes back in the room in 15 minutes. We can predict what's going to happen. Why? Because we understand the nature of small children, especially in a situational dynamic like that. And so if you have an understanding of behavior and what is the underlying mechanism that motivates activity, then you can predict it. And plus, we have decades and decades and decades of actual historical record to back it up. I mean, from the Civil War, you know, there was so-called Reconstruction, Jim Crow laws enacted, lynching at its peak, Brown versus Board of Education, the civil rights laws, voting rights laws, even the March on Washington. With every portion of legislation or policy action that had the capacity or intent to lift up the quality of life of mass numbers of non-white people, there's always been a very, very severe backlash. You know, one step forward, two steps back. And so we saw that certainly with the election of President Barack Obama. And I think we need to pause for a moment and just really think deeply about not only a black man in the White House as president, but a black male who is the product, everyone knows, of a white female and a black male. Okay, and we can also describe all of the other characteristics, you know, intelligence and articulate, patient, great character, no, you know, scandals and all that sort of stuff, and really able to steady the ship and navigate through the minefield. I mean, what he and his family endured during those presidential terms, I mean, that's like going through a minefield while a hurricane, tornado, and earthquake are all happening with a volcano simultaneously. I mean, but we haven't really stopped to think about what that did to the white psyche, having to look at the personification of their brainstem level fear, survival fear, for 8 years, and to watch him go forward and do many great things in the face of all of the 100%, 24/7 or 25/8 opposition to him. What did that do to the white psyche? That in and of itself, I think, certainly was the beginning of the backlash. And all of this, equating President Obama or First Lady Michelle Obama with guerrillas and all that kind of thing, and all of the death threats and, you know, just opposition all the way. That was the backlash. And so once things have gone this far, and let me just say, the Affordable Care Act, millions of people who were not covered by health insurance now are. That is a tremendous multi-generational quality of life change, game changer for a lot of people who are classified as non-white. And so that, of course, then was the centerpiece of attack. Of trying to dismantle not only President Obama's legacy, but to unravel all of this assistance, this support, this foundational level support that could lift the quality of life for mass numbers of Black people. That's the point of attack. And so where do you go? Where does the system of white supremacy go after that? Not to mention what's happening with the ongoing fertility challenges amongst people who classify themselves as white, not just in America, but also in throughout Europe, with the quote-unquote wave of immigration and Islam, both of which are really proxies for, you know, non-white people. Color is an invasion of color. Is happening more and more. So yeah, there was no place for, you know, this political structure to go except in the direction of Trump. And we see the same thing throughout Europe. This phenomenon is global, absolutely global, and indeed impacts all areas of people activity. The major nine areas that Mr. Fuller laid out: economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. It's all played out, every day. And we have a great opportunity now as non-white people, because it's all out there, blatant. White supremacy, that terminology is now in the mainstream media. We then hopefully can talk with other non-white people about the system of white supremacy. And one of the things that I've laid out and I want to continue to push for, particularly during this time, is that we just retire the term racism and instead use system of white supremacy exclusively. So there's no confusion about racism. Certainly in the definition, we keep it there because we know we're bridging the language and the thought that people have now and fully explaining it. But instead of using the term racism, use system of white supremacy. Especially now.
Wow. I know they're. I'm a big proponent. I'm with that completely, and I have seen the utility of that. Just if you're using system of white supremacy as opposed to racism, one of the things that it stops immediately is you do not have the, oh well, you got some Black racists. When I have been using system of white supremacy, I've never had, well, you got some Black white supremacists. No, I mean, just the terms almost insist upon logic and how we talk about this. the people that are doing this, the
exactly.
people that are practicing racism, white supremacy, are classified as white. So, I mean, it makes things very tidy in terms of where it can help push things in a much more accurate, logical way, framework, when we talk about this problem, as opposed to when we're just saying racism. It can be black race. I mean, it can be all over the place, you know, just not having clarity with terms. Wow. We do have people that called mm-hmm. in. Oh, did you have something else you wanted to add?
Oh, I just wanted to make one more point about desperation.
Mm.
You know, the level of desperation, because as you pointed out in the Dr. Wilson's words, yeah, when there is a sense of loss or not being capable of carrying forward that power dynamic, that agenda, whether it's you know, through the use of guns and violence or economic measures or the outcome of military action, you know, yeah, there's this despair. And let me just note a couple of news items. There was a Wall Street Journal article on November 29th, 2016. More whites die than are born in 1/3 of states. Trend is reshaping the social, political, and economic landscape of the U.S. I mean, that's just one example. We see the epidemic levels of abuse and who that is happening to. The vast and overwhelming majority of opioid-related deaths have been happening to people who classify themselves as white. And all of these measures, whether they're medical or law enforcement, that are very different than the reaction to the crack epidemic. You have an antidote being made available not only to medical professionals and emergency responders, but you have all of these local legislative measures being put in place so that regular lay people, families, can dispense this antidote in the case of opioid overdose. So, and by the way, you know, and if that's the case, you know, there won't be law enforcement action, even when people have, you know, illegal drugs and paraphernalia present. So the response is very different. But all of that despair and the uptick in suicides, et cetera, amongst people who classify themselves as white is very much related to this sense of despair and desperation. And it also reminds me in back in 2010, after not only, you know, the first year of President Obama's presidency, but also in addition to being based on observations and all the things that were happening to him and his family being under attack, just all of these things that were just bizarre things that were happening to me. I wrote a sort of a definition and a framework for describing what I was observing. And I called it Aryan Desperation Syndrome. And I said Aryan as opposed to white because I wanted, you know, the term Aryan orients people towards Hitler, the Third Reich, Nazi Germany. And I wanted that to be the case. So I said that Aryan Desperation Syndrome is a dynamic phenomenon observed globally in which people who classify themselves as white engage in reflexive behaviors in reaction to an increasing perception of imminent white disappearance and or deliberate behaviors. intended to further unify their approach to maintaining domination and control over the non-white global majority of people on planet Earth in order to assure white genetic survival. And I have some, you know, sort of sub-behaviors listed out under that. But it all goes towards the same thing. It's a backlash. It is where the system goes in response to a heightened sense of desperation. And as Mr. Fuller laid out in the stages of the system of white supremacy, the establishment phase, and there are a number of behaviors and actions and activities and tactics that took place in that stage, maintenance, expansion, and refinement. And we had, we meaning all of those, present on the planet, had been experiencing the refinement stage, at least into the 2000s and a little bit before that. But then where does it go from there? It jumps back to the establishment phase tactics, where there's just more open brutality, increased both police brutality and otherwise, and all of this sort of overt, almost uncontrollable eruptions, verbal even eruptions and tirades, and just a descent further into deception, just lies. It's amazing to sit back and just listen to the lies. I mean, I think the character of the lie has been remade recently in the last few months. It's sort of a different style of lying. It is 100% 100% lying and contradictions from one lie to the next lie. But it doesn't matter. They just keep moving it forward, meaning the white supremacists.
Context of white supremacy. System of white supremacy. Sabrina Johnson, our guest. If you have questions you would like to ask, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in, if you have a question, some of the people who already dialed in, we'll see if we can get a few of our callers right now. The person who dialed in, last four digits, that is so odd. Let's see. The switchboard is being a little strange. Once I get the switchboard taken care of, I will get the folks who dialed in. I saw we had a couple hands up on the line. That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing. I was looking like, the switchboard has gone absolutely bonkers. Okay. Well, once we get the switchboard taken care of, I will get the callers. Hopefully we didn't lose anyone or drop any callers in the meeting. Good job. We did not. Okay. Person who called in. Thank goodness. The first person who called in with a hand up. I think this is Thomas in New York. Did you have a question for Sabrina? You should be with us.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Josh. Yeah. Good evening to the guests. I'd like to say thank you for coming back on the show. And I just had a couple of things I wanted to say. You guys spoke about Dr. Welzing's definition of racism, white supremacy. And I do think that it's very thorough. It's much longer than mine. Mine's just two words. But it's very thorough. However, I don't call it a definition. I just want to know what you thought about this. I think that it's being that she is a doctor, a certified doctor, It's Dr. Welsden's clinical analysis and scientific diagnosis based off of Mr. Fuller's definition is how I generally like to put it, that this is this isn't just a definition that can be played with. This is coming from a doctor. That's usually what I tell other victims that I speak to when I show them her what I call clinical analysis of what the problem is. I just wonder what you thought of that.
Yeah, well, hopefully that could help. Another approach is to say, well, what is your definition, or what is a more accurate definition? If this one is problematic in some way, what is it that can explain every dynamic? Those nine areas all over the world so consistently over hundreds of years. And number two, factually, black plus white equals color. Now, the question becomes, given that and given the global demographics, with people who classify themselves as white being less than a tenth of the world's population, and their genetic recessive status when it comes to skin coloration, either they are trying to survive as white on this planet, or they're not. And if someone has evidence that they're not, have them bring it forward. And it's very, very easy. Pick up any newspaper any day, and it's very easy to prove that that's not the case. But I hope that people, there's sort of a competing thought here. You know, we, under more ideal circumstances, we would think that a person who has, you know, particular skill and expertise, you know, in a discipline, you know, we would hope that that person would be accorded, some more credibility in terms of their analysis. On the other hand, we want to make sure that people feel that an understanding and the capability to analyze and reach conclusions is something that's accessible to everybody. You don't need a medical degree to assert logic. Mr. Fuller does not have a medical degree. He doesn't have a degree at all. But yet he did deep thinking in quiet, asking questions, and started from a position of humility. I don't know. There's no shame in saying I don't know. That is the point of power. If you can acknowledge that you don't know, you're confused, or you don't understand something, you are on your way to understanding and, you know, utilizing all of that brain capacity, that thinking capacity, that problem-solving capability, but you start there. And so, while yes, she, as a trained and experienced psychiatrist, a medical doctor, certainly that was brought to bear in her analyses, but at the same time, you don't need that level of training and expertise just to think clearly and logically and do problem solving.
Did you have another question, Thomason?
Thank you very much. Oh. Yes, I do. And I just wanted to thank you, Gus, for that question you asked earlier and the clarity that the guest brought. You asked how to engage blacks who come off with whites are not superior, you know, automatically, and they shut down anything you're saying. And I'm working on skills to engage those people as well. My last question is, to the guest, You mentioned that the system of white supremacy is being used more in the mainstream media. Do you think, like I do, that white's attempt to define white supremacy for us, to control how we use that term and how we look at that term? Like racist prior to the Trump candidacy, I never heard whites call another white racist, you know, in the mainstream media. Then it was like every day. And it's sort of like they've redefined how we should look at a racist. Now blacks look at Donald Trump as being a racist, not all whites. You think that that's the attempt to redefine white supremacy? And I'll leave my line. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your questions and support, and support of cows as well. I think in part that's going on. I also think that it's a reaction to, it's sort of a gut level reaction to the level of desperation and despair. It's almost like someone who is, you know, terminally ill. You know, at that point, you know, it doesn't so much matter if you're eating something unhealthy or not. For instance, there's this level of just desperation that has caused them to abandon some of the key protocols that had been previously in place. And previously it was, okay, the white supremacists are the, you know, the three-tooth guy with a red pickup truck with a gun rack on the back who's got a swastika tattooed on his forehead. You know, those are the kinds of images and people that people who classify themselves as white would point to as quote-unquote white supremacists. But I think it's a rallying cry, also a reminder, a call to action for those who classify themselves as white. That, you know, it's a different ball game now. You know, this is the last inning. And so we're going to have to do things differently now. And so all of that politically correctness and all of that, you know, gotta let it go right now.
Appreciate that, Thomas, in New York. The article that Sabrina Johnson mentioned earlier, it was not just, she mentioned the Wall Street Journal post, which is accurate. She had it to the date. It was in many outlets. The Washington Post on the very same day in November also had a report by the very same title that I put on my Facebook page. And within that article, great sentence, they were talking to different folks about how this trend was happening. They said that it was going to be touching Sabrina Johnson's own South Carolina soon. It's going to be one of those states with more white people dying than being born. But the sentence was, it's going to be a long time before the white people aren't a very powerful political force. That was from one of the professors. And I thought, that is important. That might even be the most important sentence to keep in mind when reading these reports in the system of white supremacy. The person who dialed in.
Yes. Very interesting. that was, by the way, at the Chris Wilson Institute, as we meet, we assemble a package of news articles. And that was one of them that was included in the December 2016 Institute meeting. And yes, white deaths outpacing births.
I think this is retired firefighter. If you had a question for Sabrina Johnson, you should be with us, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone.
Greetings.
Greetings.
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Sabrina, you were, I guess you were about to go into the subject matter that I was going to ask you about, Dr. Welsing's center. Could you tell us on the, give us an idea of the daily process, what takes place, and being with the with her transitioning, how the center and the people who are still operating, what type of adjustments that was or has been made?
Okay, well, thank you for your question. And so the Kress-Welsing Institute is a lecture series, and we have continued it and continued it in the same format that she laid out, with a couple of adjustments because, of course, she isn't physically present there. So instead, I provide some historical and context information concerning her, a little bit of biographical information about Dr. Welsing and how the Institute was started and why. And then we continue just as she did. I always, because her legacy is her work. Her work is her words. Her words, whether they were delivered, by audio or written words, that stands on its own and speaks for itself. And so I always want to include and do include a segment within the Institute meeting, and I entitle it Welsing Speaks. And we listen to or look at either video footage or audio footage of her delivering some messaging that's relevant to whatever theme or topic has been selected for the evening. And just as she did, as Gus reminded us many times, she said reading is more important than watching TV, and she advocated reading and did practice reading at least 3 newspapers a day. And so she would scour the newspapers and identify articles of interest and put together a package, and that would prompt discussion during the Institute meetings. There would be question and answers, and so we've carried it forward in the same spirit and format procedurally as she did, because it worked. And our work continues even in the absence of her physical presence. She's still with us in so many ways. She's embedded in many of us. And thanks to people like us, the reach of her work has been and continues to be expanded. And let me just also take the time to note that the winter 2016 edition of Black Child Journal, the publisher is Dr. Usini Eugene Perkins out of Chicago, who grew up with Dr. Welsing, and her sisters, Mama Lauren Kress Love, and Mama Barbara Lawrence, who is also deceased. But Baba Usini, Dr. Usini, arranged the winter 2016 edition would be a total tribute to Dr. Welsing. And so a number of people contributed articles about Dr. Welsing. Her sister, Mama Lauren, contributed an article about them, their family life, growing up as sisters and their household. And it's a very, very interesting and delightful read and insight into early life and sort of just the regular aspects of family life with Dr. Welsing early on. And it's a perspective that only Mama Lauren can provide. But a number of other people contributed articles, including Dr. Marimba Ani, Dr. Kobe Cambone, and others to this tribute edition. And I was asked also to write about the Creswell-Welsing Institute. So I wrote a piece that kind of lays out the Institute, what it is, how it functions, how it was organized, and or is organized, and how it continues. So that might be of interest to you all, and I can make information available to Gus about how others might get a copy of the winter edition that is a full tribute to Dr. Welsing.
Last but not least, one thing I always noticed about Welsing, and I had been listening to her since I'm trying to think what are those little small tapes that that used to came before DVDs and ID when she was even on tape
cassette.
Yeah, even back in the time when it was cassettes and whatnot, I used to listen to her, and she was just an aura of calmness, even when people were shouting or with some sort of disagreement or something that really didn't make any sense. How calm she was in her articulation and answering a question or questions. And I know you have been around her much more than a lot of people, especially the people that are listening to you now. Could you give us some examples of that through your experiences with her?
Sure, and I think that's very much noteworthy, and I'm glad you brought that forward, because that was one of those distinctive characteristics about her level of calm. And it comes from, personal characteristics. That's one thing. But really having a clear understanding. Once you have that, there's no need to get hyped and really, into an emotional zigzag, where you're at risk of going off track and not communicating effectively what needs to be laid out, or, just being emotional. You can assert logic from a position of calm. But also, and it's interesting because at her, we held a 40-day ancestral celebration and ceremony for Dr. Welsing. I spoke, and one of the things that I talked about that she did that we should enact ourselves, and that's to embody calm, both for our own health reasons, but also when you think about what we're doing, we're in a war, and we're engaging in counter war. And anyone who studies or practices martial arts knows that you're not engaging with emotion. You are calm. You are relaxed. And that enables you to do whatever you have to do to take care of business. And there's a lot of energy expended, physically in a martial situation. But it comes, you have to start from being relaxed and calm. And you can't get upset about, you know, what somebody is saying to you or whatever. If you're, you know, carrying forward a precise discipline, that's why they call martial arts a discipline, not so much a sport. If you're enacting that, then you have to do it from a place of calm. And we need to do whatever we can do to keep our blood pressure down, because the assaults and the opposition and the attacks are 24/7 in the system of white supremacy. We are in a war. So, yes, let's embody calm and do whatever it takes to, you know, whether it's yoga or tai chi. You know, that's another thing I'm mentioning, the things that we need to be doing now with things as they are in the White House as ground zero of sort of color confrontation right now. We have to do what we have to have constructive mechanisms and outlets for our stress and keeping us healthy mentally and physically. And so embodying calm, be calm, just, you know, watch her. You can, and she did. We saw her decimate William Shockley ever so calmly.
Oh, yes.
And Phil Donahue, too.
Mm-hmm. Did that
thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Context of white supremacy. If other folks, if you have a question that you wanted to ask, the person who dialed in, last four digits, 5771, 5771. Did you have a question for Sabrina? You should be with us.
Okay.
I'm sorry? Are you there, sir?
Oh, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Sorry about that. I had the mute button on. Greetings, Gus, and greetings, Sabrina.
Greetings.
I got a question in regards to the relationship between non-white black people and other non-white people in regards to, say, like Asians and Hispanics. It seems like in our society, there's seems to be non-white people that are not black and non-white black people who are kind of engaging in not very codified ways. And I understand that's because of, you know, the system of white supremacy we live in, because of the fact that, you know, they cause all this confusion amongst all non-white people. But I wanted to ask, do you think in order for us to beat this system of white supremacy, would it just be satisfactory just for the group of non-white people to be codified among themselves, or do we have to have a collective effort of all non-white people, black, Asian, Hispanics, to defeat this system of white supremacy?
Thank you for your question. The first comment is about yes, the non-white color stratification, which is part of the system of white supremacy, both between the broad categories and within each of those categories. You know, there's a sub-stratification of color, you know, amongst black people, amongst so-called Latino or Hispanic people, et cetera, et cetera. And that's part of the system, certainly. But in terms of having all non-white people practicing or all black people, we don't know what the number is. We are seeking a critical mass of people who are classified as non-white, who have an understanding of the system of white supremacy, the functional definition, what it is that we're dealing with, are oriented towards the goal objective of replacing the system of white supremacy with a system of justice, and who are enacting in their daily individual lives and behavior the behavior code, which was initiated by Mr. Fuller as the what he called the 10 stops. And then, of course, Dr. Wellspring added some content and labeled it the Counter-Racism Behavior Code for Black Self and Group Respect and Black Mental Health. And they're very simple behaviors that don't require you to make any kind of a financial investment. You don't have to travel. You don't have to. It's just in your daily life every day. Things that you do and things that you don't do. And so once we get a critical mass of people having that understanding, that's what can take us to our goal objective. Now, Dr. Wellspring, and I hope you can sort of follow a mental picture of this, in illustrating the role that we play, we meaning those who are classified as non-white, under the system of white supremacy, particularly those who are called black people. She said, and drew, if you can picture a sort of the simplistic drawing of a roof. It's a big triangle, right? And then there's one pillar on one side holding it up, and one pillar on the other side holding it up. So just these two pillars. And these, the edifice, the roof, is the system of white supremacy. And one of the pillars is the one-tenth population of people who classify themselves as white on planet Earth. And it is through white intent to survive as white that holds up that side of the edifice. The other pillar is composed of non-white people, the global majority, the nine-tenths or more population on this planet. And we are propping up through our behaviors, mostly our destructive behaviors, within and amongst each other. That is helping to hold up the system of white supremacy. That is black and other shades of black, self-hatred. And so if we can, we don't anticipate, we don't expect, should not expect that the white intent to survive pillar is going to change or move. We shouldn't expect that. There's no evidence that that is the case, and we have hundreds of years of evidence to say the contrary. The opportunity we have is with our own behavior as non-white people. If we can dismantle that pillar through our behavior in a united, independent way, just picture, you know, a portion of one pillar diminishing, being pulled out, crumbling. So once that pillar falls, the edifice can no longer stand. The system of white supremacy will collapse if we, those who are classified as non-white, stop propping it up with our behavior towards each other. And so those, the behavior code for black self and group respect. One, stop name-calling one another. Two, stop gossiping about one another. Three, stop squabbling with one another. 4, stop snitching on one another, informing on one another for reasons of personal gain. 5, stop cursing one another. 6, stop being discourteous to one another. 7, stop being disrespectful to one another. 8, stop stealing from one another. 9, stop robbing one another. 10, stop fighting one another. 11, stop killing one another. 12, stop throwing down trash where black people live, work, and play. Stop making dirt and filth the norm. 13, stop using and selling drugs to one another. 14, stop black children from thinking that as children they can be adequate mothers and fathers. 15, stop believing that welfare will save you. Start believing in prosperity. 16, stop pretending that racism, white supremacy does not exist. And 17, stop being divided and conquered. Stop allowing black, brown, red, and yellow peoples being divided by white supremacy. Those are sort of the bricks or the components of that pillar that we as non-white people control. And if we can cause that pillar to collapse, all of that black self-hatred, all of that destructive behavior amongst and between each other as non-white people, then the whole thing is going to come tumbling down. And then it is our work to replace it with a system of justice.
So when you refer to we, you know, each other, you're referring to all non-white people, not just non-white black people, right?
Yes. Certainly because there is more of the attack thrust at black people because they have the most potential to cause white genetic annihilation, and particularly the black male, because only males can impose sexual intercourse. Yeah, it's critical that black people have an understanding, but other non-white people as well, because the system will utilize, the system of white supremacy will utilize other non-whites as buffers and as pawns to disrupt and dismantle and black people as well. I mean, we have all of these behavioral issues within the grouping of black people, as well as brown people and yellow people and red people, as the classifications are noted.
Okay.
So it's a critical mass. So just do what we can every day to help more people, whoever the people are in our circle of interaction, help them understand. Give them the definition, the functional definition of white supremacy, racism.
Well, thank you, Dr. Johnson. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Johnson, wow.
Wait. Did he say Dr. Johnson? Oh, no. I'm not a doctor.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Johnson.
thank you. You can call me Sabrina.
Thank you.
Went from...
thanks. I didn't catch that.
You sounded like a doctor, so...
Take it as a compliment. Take it as a compliment. One of the things that I did think was very important, black self-respect, I think that, and reading is more important than watching television. I think it would be pretty challenging to hear Dr. Welsing or see her give an interview and to have her not mention one of those two, if not both, before the conclusion of the broadcast. Black self-respect as it relates to people that have felt the need over the past year or so to what they call defend Dr. Welsing's legacy. Like if someone, says, well, I don't agree with her theory of white genetic annihilation. I think that's hogwash. I think it's rubbish. You know, everything that she said, all of that is just a bunch of nonsense. And people saying, hey, I appreciate Dr. Welsing's work. And anyone who says that, you got a fight on your hands, or at least you're going to get a barrage of nasty names for as long as I can think of them to call you. What do you say to people who say that, you know, they have to defend Dr. Welsing against people disparaging her legacy?
Well, again, we want to minimize conflict amongst and between people who are classified as non-white. So you can ask questions strategically and do it in a respectful tone, a calm tone, and just ask questions to stoke some thinking. Why is it that you don't agree with, or what is it specifically about what she said that you don't agree with? And by the way, confirm that what, you know, a person is claiming Dr. Welsing to have said is something that Dr. Welsing actually said, because she, Dr. Welsing noted on a number of occasions that, you know, there's this sort of backstage rumor that she was married to a white man who left her, and, you know, she's bitter, and that's why she talks about nothing but race and racism all the time. And that is not true, absolutely not true. But somehow people just really want to believe that. And Dr. Welsing talked about this one person she encountered, you know, who brought that forward. And Dr. Welsing said, no, sweetheart, that's not true. I never have been married to a white man. You know, my husband was crystal black, in fact. And the young lady just said, yes, you were. You were married to a white man. I mean, So people latch on to things. And so the first thing to do is to confirm if what the person's thinking is accurate in terms of what Dr. Welsing put forward. And secondly, just ask questions. Well, how would you explain, you know, this particular phenomena? Or why do you think, as it's been reported, educated white women voted more for Trump than they did for Hillary? You know, what is your thinking about that? Or, you know, pick any news item, anything in the news, and just ask some questions about it. And it's not to be combative. It's more to stoke some critical thinking about what's going on, because chances are, you know, there's sort of a subcurrent of, I really don't want to believe this in a lot of non-white people, in terms of acknowledging, accepting the fact that there's a system of white supremacy that we are existing within. And so what does that mean for me and my behavior or my thinking, or am I going to have to do something? And so there's this resistance that I think oftentimes is sort of present there in the background that we have to contend with. But help people to think by asking questions. You can't underscore the value of asking questions, critical questions, including that quintessential question, why?
Outstanding. Outstanding. I know I have heard Dr. Welsing address this specifically in lectures where some black person disparaged her work and had nothing but nasty things to say about her. And she said, you know, hey, that's their view. I'm not going to stand up here and talk bad about them or what have you. I'm going to exercise black self-respect. respect. And in that lecture, she did not want anyone who, you know, said, well, I like Dr. Welsing's work. She did not want them to go out and, you know, bash another black person or what have you who disagreed with her work. Just dignified, scientific, all the way through, in every way. One of the other things that I wanted to ask as well, and I have the issue, Sabrina Johnson actually mailed me a copy. I was really tickled to get it. That's what I spent a lot of my Sunday afternoon doing. Sat outside, got the little bit of sunshine that was available, and read. You mentioned Dr. Welsing. She read the newspaper, three newspapers daily. That's something that I remind listeners on a regular basis to pay attention to the news. That's something I always appreciate about Dr. Welsing. In fact, I've said consistently that was a part of the growth in our relationship, me being on the opposite coast, was talking about news and faxing her articles and things that she even used sometimes for the Welsing Institute, sending her just different things that I came across. And that's something that I, you know, all the time, really make sure you're paying attention to things that are happening, because they're constantly talking about the system of white supremacy, even though they won't use that phrase. Dr. Welsing also mentioned a lot of books over the years when she was on this broadcast. She mentioned, it's in the ISIS paper, she mentioned Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly's Racial Matters, the FBI Secret File on Black America from 1960 to 1971. He was a guest on the program to discuss that book. Marcus Rediker, The Slave Ship, he was a guest on the program last year to discuss that book. Sycamore Row by John Grisham, which is fiction. The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Reshape American Politics by Thomas B. Edsall. It is amazing. She mentioned that book when she was on our program in 2012. And that guy wrote an article, Thomas B. Edsall, that I referenced when I wrote about her prediction that Trump was going to win, where he was talking about the election and some of these same factors that are present in The Age of Austerity, which was published in 2012. Wow. I mean, it really gets to a lot of, you know, how Trump came to power. Some of the other books that she mentioned, The Zone of Interest by Martin Amis, Einstein on Race and Racism by Fred Giroux. She really liked that one. She mentioned that one a few times. And Lothrop Stoddard, she mentioned that at the final Welsing Institute lecture that she did, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, which we did as our final books, or one of our last books for the 2016 year. Are there any other books that Dr. Welsing referenced in the time that you were around her, or commentary about any of the books that we mentioned, if she mentioned any of those?
Yes. So the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday is the third Monday of January. And so many years ago, I started having what I call the Justice Weekend Gathering. And so on that Sunday before the Martin Luther King holiday, I'd host a gathering at my home with Dr. Welsing. In years past, Mr. Fuller and some institute students. And, we would feature particular books at that time. We really appreciated Patrick Buchanan's works, Death of the West, and I think Suicide of Western Civilization, and a number of books. I think those were in like the early 2000s, if I have that in my head right. But a lot of Patrick Buchanan's books. Breaking Rank, she was, you know, very interested in the mindset of race soldiers, as Mr. Fuller would call them, law enforcement officers. And, you know, what is really happening in the psyche of white males who are police officers with the, I thought he had a weapon, I thought he had a weapon, I thought he had a weapon, justifiable homicide scenarios that we see played out over and over and over and over again. So Breaking Rank was one that she mentioned. And I have revisited The Rising Tide of, The Rising Tide of White...
Color Against White World Supremacy.
white world supremacy. Yes, yes, indeed. And there were some pretty technical books on melanin pigmentation. The exact title is not of one of them is not coming to me right now, but I know melanin and pigmentation is in the title. Let me think about that. Definitely Slave Ship was, somewhat recent. She had great appreciation for the Henrietta Lacks story.
Hmm.
As well, we discussed that at length.
What were the thoughts about that book? Is it the Rebecca Skloot, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, The Immortal Life. Yeah. Because, I mean, when you think about the potency at the cellular level of, this black woman and basically, providing the basis for a whole medical discipline and research field, it's just really, really powerful. And certainly, being a physician and knowing, having a particular perspective on the medical field, allopathic medicine as a whole, and what happens in research hospitals and, the setting in Baltimore and all of that is, just very, very interesting, from a scientific and biological perspective. She found it very interesting.
That's another one we did on the book club, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. We've been talking about that a lot since the HBO film just came out. And Norm Stamper, I think five-time guest on mm-hmm. the program. We talked about Breaking Rank and his more recent book that came out last mm-hmm. year. I also wanted to ask, how have you, I guess I'll phrase it this way, can you share a time where you have applied counter-racism on your job? I know workplace racism is a subject that is near to my heart, something we try to talk about often. Can you share a time where you've had to apply counter-racist techniques on the job?
Oh, yeah. Where do I begin? Oh, my. Let's see. Which one will I pick? Oh, there was a situation, I'm trying to think about the year, probably, I'd say 98, 99 time frame. Hey, what year, what was the first year that Tiger Woods won the Masters? Do you recall offhand?
I think that was 97, I think, 97.
Okay, then yes, I'm pretty sure this was around the 98 time frame then. Someone had found a paper left on the copier, the Xerox machine, and it had some white supremacist writings on it. So someone had found that. And they took it to, I guess, someone in HR, human resources, or maybe they took it to the, assistant administrator or whomever. Anyway, so the HR person, head, was a white female who I had already clashed with because she had tried to block a promotion that had been enacted for me. And by the way, I used counter-racist logic to deal with that situation, so I did get the promotion. But anyway, this other situation where there's this white supremacist material left on the copier. So she, this white female, racist suspect, had the assistant administrator, the most senior person in that division, send out an email to, you know, everyone in the division saying there would be zero tolerance of discussion about such in this workplace. There was no investigation done or anything like that as to where it came from or anything like that. And so I wrote this 3-page response that noted that there was no investigation done. And, you know, I asked a number of questions about that. And this zero tolerance on discussion about anything to do with racism that was noted, I thought that that was inappropriate, because if you're not having a discussion about it, it's not being dealt with, and certainly it is present in the organization. And so I listed all of the reasons why we needed to have discussion about these topics, and so that I got the attention of a number of senior folks, and yeah, there was not an investigation about that particular incident, but there was a rescinding of that decision or that directive to have no discussion about racism in the workplace. But it was according to code, and there were incidents where there was many incidents, but I can say, particularly with Mr. Fuller's guidance, I have personally witnessed and have knowledge of, I know at least 4 situations where people who, black males in particular, who were coming under attack in various job settings, whether it's sort of a blue-collar situation or a so-called white-collar office situation, whether it's highly technical or not, I have seen them be successful by practicing counter-racist logic and applying it in the workplace setting. And certainly Dr. Welsing did the same thing in support of a black female law enforcement officer who was verbally attacked on the job. And through her very calm, quiet tone of discussion about the system of white supremacy in the workplace, was able to be out unstressed and be protected from that environment for a number of years. And again, it's just having an understanding of what motivates people's behavior, those who classify themselves as white, and the skillful use of words, what you say, what you don't say, and particularly utilizing the Constitution. Various specific amendments, oftentimes the 14th and the 5th, but utilizing the Constitution to back you up, to align yourself with the mission of the organization, whatever it is, and utilize the Constitution and utilize codified language that will work for you and against them. You know, that's the sort of the recipe. But there have been a number of situations. Yeah, I was able to unblock the promotion that was being blocked by a white female by utilizing those kinds of principles. And, you know, being accustomed to being in situations with white females in particular. So you have, I've found it helpful to make a preemptive strike to set forward before the meeting gets underway or the discussion that if a white female cries during this exchange, then she needs to excuse herself from the room and not serve as a disturbance or a derailment of this discussion. Because oftentimes that is used as a strategic measure, a tactical measure by white females to unravel a discussion about racism. So, yeah, there are many examples,
Wow. Now that counter-racist suggestion, that is worthy of a title, Dr. Sabrina Johnson, to have the preemptive strike to make sure that the weeping white woman does not strike. That is lovely. That can be applied. We have workplace racism every Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern. I have discussed that before, and I think I heard that with Farrah Winfrey. I said Sabrina Johnson has done great work. She interviewed Farrah Winfrey. I think that came up in your interview with Farrah Winfrey, and I asked her about that, and she said that she was told that a black male told her, and blah, 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 and I've used that. I've used that in counter-racist context where I saw a white woman. She was tuning up. She was getting ready to go, whoa, 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 whoa. If that's what's going to happen, you are going to have to exit, because that will just throw everything off. And, you know, if you got to go weep for a few minutes, like, just step outside, because that will totally ruin everything. And people got a little bit rowdy at first, but thankfully all the non-white people were supportive. Like, yeah, we have got a serious issue, and we're not going to. So once the non-white people were on board, that sealed it. So she got her act together, and that was that. But I mean, you really preemptive. If you need to go ahead and just say that up front, great, but man, that can ruin everything. A white woman in a few Rosewood, Kentucky, like man, the whole world.
Yeah,
can
I call it the teardrop routine. yeah, and so it's amazing. I was at a training course. It happened to be at Harvard. And this white woman, there were a whole bunch of folks from, in fact, it was an international training. So there are folks from all over the world there. But this white woman, and they were talking about negotiation and various tactics for negotiating. This white woman stood up and said, well, when I don't get my way in workplace situations, I just cry. And she just admitted it, just right then and there, blatant, wide open.
Wow. I could not imagine me as a black male. I could not imagine that working at any point in my career. Just say, I'm just going to shed a tear or two and see if I can get a little sympathy, get this raise. Like, I could not imagine that at all, but I have seen that in action with what, oh man, that great suggestion. Really, about the only thing I was thinking is I have heard on occasion, not as much, but on occasion, even a white man pulling that. So if you think that could happen, you might even, you know, if you need to make it not gender specific, fine, no problem. If anyone feels like they are going to need to weep for a second, if you could excuse yourself, gain your composure. We have serious issues that need to be addressed, and that could be an unnecessary distraction. So if you need a few moments, just step outside, and then we can get right back to business. I wanted to read a little bit from your essay in the Black Child Journal, and then if you want to tell folks how they can obtain a copy, if that's possible, and or how they can support the ongoing Crest Welsing Institute. The portion that I want to read, this is on page 48 and 49 from your essay, and you just kind of have some bullet points of some of the things lessons that you got from Dr. Welsing. You strike the value and power in asking questions is without limits. The drive to think and learn happens through questions and taking us beyond surface observation into the realm of interpretation and establishing relevance. The pivotal action that Dr. Welsing took in asking that quintessential question, why, ushered in a set of resultant actions that changed the course of history. The critical question, why, enlists the brain computer to work on solutions even when we're not consciously focused on the issue. Its importance to the research process cannot be overstated. Dr. Welsing frequently reminded us that young children practice posing this foundational question unceasingly as they attempt to establish cause and effect relationship. Cause and effect relationships. Answers to children's innate curiosity turn the soil in preparation to receive additional seeds for boundless growth in the appetite for and acquisition of knowledge and understanding. Finally, this last paragraph, Dr. Welsing lived the principles she discussed and served as an impeccable model for constructive behavior that advances our efforts towards producing justice. Her frequent refrain that asked participants to repeat, "Reading is more important than watching TV," is evident by her breadth of knowledge about topics and awareness of current events. She advocated reading at least 3 newspapers per day. The evidence of white supremacy as a global system is laid out in news articles reporting on the activities of people and institutions every day. Even when the topic of racism is not explicitly cited in the news, the connections are there and apparent for those with the analytical and interpretive skills that Dr. Welsing demonstrated and taught. Ashe. If folks can get a copy of the Black Child Journal where this essay is printed, and or if they want to support financially the Welsing Institute's ongoing efforts, how can they do so?
Okay, in terms of Black Child Journal, they can email blackchildjournal@gmail.com. So that's blackchildjournal@gmail.com. And, request a copy, and they'll let you know how to, what the mailing arrangements are. And Dr. Usini Perkins, again, who is the publisher, offered, and this was an unsolicited offer, but offered that a portion of the proceeds from the sale of each Black Child Journal will go towards supporting the Cress Welsing Institute. So we certainly appreciate that tremendously and really lift him up. And I'll just share that in talking with him, we discovered that he and I were both present at the National Black Holistic Retreat when the ISIS papers was first made available for sale, many, many years ago. So that was a particularly delightful discovery that we made in our interaction, discussing the planning for this edition, special tribute edition. So I wanted to just share that. It's a small world. Interesting how things have come back around. Yeah. And I think that, let me also share this. There will be some products available that will, help in terms of sharing the information, that we've been engaged in locally within the next couple months. For instance, we're going to do a DVD of the community commemoration and call to action event that we held in honor of Dr. Welsing on her birthday last month. We're going to make that available. And that will give folks some insights about what particular activities the Institute has been undertaking since her transition, but also a lot of other organizations that have conducted some kind of memorial or that sort of thing. And I'd also like to call people's attention to a couple of items that we featured at the commemoration. I really wanted there to be, to have people orient themselves towards youth and how it is that we will help them understand this knowledge, this information, this analysis, these definitions, etc., that they are going to need to be able to carry forward what it is that we're building. And so I featured two, very youthful, tremendously smart and dedicated young Black males. There was one Black male named Carlton Thompson, who's 11 years old, and he's part of the Sunshine Youth Division, founded by Sister Nia Tuex, who's also a student of the Institute, the Crest-Wilson Institute. And he memorized and recited Dr. Welsing's Black Oath, the Pledge of Allegiance for Black people to Black self-respect. And the other one is a young man who is 13 years old. He's a scholar activist and student at the Howard University Middle School of Mathematics and Science. His name is Ryan E. Battle. And I would invite people to do a search and check him out on YouTube. Ryan is a very, very, very uniquely talented young man. And he did basically a keynote address. And he picked the topic, and the topic was gentrification of the mind. He's brilliant and heartwarming in so many ways. And I'd also like to, you know, as we were talking about the functional definition and linking it with youth, you know, we have a lot of Black students who recite Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, which is great. I would say let's challenge our teachers, parents, and as teachers and parents and others, challenge our youth to memorize the functional definition of white supremacy. Let's get that in the hands and the minds of youth as well. I wanted to just share that. The best way to support, in future programs, I'll provide some information about, financial donations that people might want to make towards the upkeep, the operational cost for the Crest-Wilson Institute. But for now, let me just say the best way to support the Institute is to support Dr. Welsing's legacy by sharing, memorizing the functional definition of white supremacy, of racism, getting that tied into all of your circles of people that you interact with, and embracing Black, embodying calm, practicing respect, behavior code. Those are the things on a day-by-day basis, minimizing contact and minimizing conflict with other non-white people. Those are the things that will support her legacy and move us towards the yet unfinished business. Her cosmic assignment is our work as we continue to replace white supremacy with justice, a system of justice. So those are the things that you can do to support. And support COWS. Gus, you're doing phenomenal work. It's much appreciated. I'm not surprised to hear that you're one of the scouts sending in informational news items over the years as well. So much appreciation. Keep doing what you're doing. Let me know how I can be supportive, and others here can be supportive of it as well. And thank you for having me on, and I appreciate all of the questions that have come forward as well. So thank you to your listeners.
Absolutely. We appreciate you sharing some of your time and insight with us. Thomas in New York said he had one more question he wanted to get in before we let you enjoy the rest of your Sunday evening. Thomas in New York, are you there?
Yes, I am. I do have one more question for the guest. This is in reference to the lack to give you name of some more books. The book that we read in the book study session, The Color of Confrontation, what was it? The full title of that, Gus?
Lothrop Stoddard's book?
Yes.
The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy.
Absolutely. When we started reading that book, I started saying, you know, Dr. Weldon is prophesizing to us that the white supremacists, Miss Sabrina Johnson, do you remember the contents of that book?
Somewhat.
Okay. In the question probably, either way, I just saw it as her prophesizing that the future of white supremacy depends upon their control over the region that today is called China. And when I see Trump being very aggressive in that region right now, I just, even going as far as to tell us that people with no satellites have intercontinental ballistic missiles that they can't guide with no satellites. I just wanted to know if you think that prophecy that I think that she was giving us for telling us to read that book before she passed is true or not. And I'm with my wife.
Well, I think the broader discussion, let me just back up and say where we often make our mistake in, trying to understand what's going on is that we put forward our viewpoint of things. And the key really is to understand the white supremacy mindset. And so when we look at the broader discussion, and it's laid out, it's very overt and clear in that particular book, The Rising Tide. When there, the broader discussion about white supremacy and what is of concern to people who classify themselves as white, I think that sort of just that general discussion is what, is why she was encouraging folks to read that. I didn't pose that specific question to her or focus in the sort of the strategic China element of that to her. So I can't definitively say, but I based on knowing her and her priorities for helping us to understand, I would think just the broader discussion is from helping us to see what's in the psyche of the people who classify themselves as white, what mindset orients them towards their behavior. I think that's what she was probably getting at.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. She talked about that book quite a bit. I do remember when we were, that was another moment, we're reading that book. It was just like, wow, at that time period where, because I think we read that right as Trump, it was right at the end of November. I think Trump had just been elected when we started reading that, or we were right in the middle of it. But it was very much the things that he, the concerns that he had were identical. He could have given Trump his talking points to walk him through the election cycle last year and would have came out about the same. But I just wanted to get this in because there have been many moments over the past little over a year where I've said, man, I wish, you know, all those times that we talked to Dr. Welsing, I wish I'd asked this or I wish I'd asked this. One of those, and you said it, I had it on my list to ask, and then you used the term just now. She referred to the business of producing justice and eliminating permanently the system of white supremacy. She referred to that as our cosmic assignment, our cosmic duty, our cosmic work. And I always, or recently I've been like, wow, I wish I had asked her to explain why did she use that phrasing? Why did she describe this as our cosmic duty? Just given your time with Dr. Welsing, what are your thoughts on why she referenced this as our cosmic assignment?
Yeah, and she often referred to it as definitely as her cosmic assignment, because when one looks back on one's life, you can see how, wow, this little disparate data point, maybe at that particular time, this thing that happened, you know, you might make note of it, but you don't really focus on it. And then this thing happened, and that thing happened, and the other thing happened. And all of these things, they're sort of strange phenomenon in isolation. You know, she talked about, and I'm sure she shared in some of the interviews and other dialogues you've had, the incident wherein her brother-in-law, who was in the astronaut, was an astronaut and in a training aircraft training situation, and he was killed. She was sitting in her apartment in D.C. The plane crash happened in California, and she was just sitting in her apartment and looking at her wall. It was like a big screen TV, and we didn't even have big screen TVs back then. It was like a huge portion of the wall became this screen, and she saw him trying to escape out of a plane, her brother-in-law. It just a visual manifestation happened, and then it went away, and shortly thereafter, she got a call from her mother saying that her sister's husband, her brother-in-law, had been killed in a plane crash. And, you know, there was that. Her parents and her grandparents had ties to, you know, Ida B. Wells. Dr. Welsing herself met and encountered and had a very lengthy discussion with Malcolm X. Richard Wright wrote some of his works, his classic works, in one of Dr. Welsing's relatives' home. You know, Dr. Welsing making the request as her graduation, her college graduation gift, to go to Germany and talk with the people there to ask them questions about what they knew concerning what was happening to their neighbors, Semites of the Jewish religion, during the Jewish Holocaust. Her finally listening to an inner voice that told her to go to this particular meeting when she didn't go to those kinds of meetings at the time, the Black Power meeting, where she encountered Neely Fuller Jr., just heard his voice, you know, out of a corner in a room, and what that ushered in. And, all of these, you know, just interesting situational dynamics that when you look at them in their sort of aggregate, you know, this was meant to be. All of these things are meaningful, and they have an origin that is maybe outside of our specific knowing or our, you know, usual capability. How is it that someone envision something that was happening while it was happening 3,000 miles away, you know, with, you know, no introductory connection to, you know, what happened, what was going on at that particular moment. All of these things, and just the truth and justice, these are our higher principles that we can see were important and valued with our ancient ancestors. For instance, in the Nile Valley region of Africa, and we can see it on, it's memorialized on temple walls. And so her even titling the her book, the Isis Papers, her view of her role, remembering as, you know, part of the Isis story, what she did in putting back together the pieces of the dismembered black, perfect black, Osiris, husband, brother, you know, all of that has some meaning that's beyond, I think, you know, what we can envision from ourselves. There's a larger context that this all fits within. The Earth is not the only planet. This isn't the only galaxy, the Milky Way. You know, there's a broader context, and something has set these things in motion. And it is because of, you know, the intense focus and determination and the breakthroughs that happened, I think, that, you know, caused her to view this as her cosmic assignment and our work continuing forward to make it happen.
Context of white supremacy. Well stated, Dr. Sabrina Johnson. She got her title out during the broadcast today. It has been outstanding hearing your views and just learning more about Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Her sister, one of her sisters, Lauren Cress Love, she spoke about both of their brother-in-law, Robert Lawrence, first astronaut. She talked extensively during her most recent visit on the program and the racism that they experienced around his death, her thoughts about how he died. She talked about that extensively. That was another moment where I was kind of upset at myself because I didn't know any, I had not heard about that from Dr. Welsing. I didn't know about any of that until I spoke with her sister, Lauren Cress Love. But yeah, it's amazing when you can kind of get more information as to how Dr. Welsing evolved, the family, all of that, just getting more pieces to the puzzle. It is amazing. We will definitely have you back on the program to continue the dialogue and to make sure that people continue to go out and support the Cress Welsing Institute. It'll be May 11th, second Thursday of every month. So next month it'll be May 11th. They'll meet again in June, and then they'll have the summer break, and then it should be starting back up in September. But Washington, D.C., Blackburn Center on the campus of Howard University, 7 p.m. Coming up Thursday, May 11th. You can go out. Great opportunity to network. I am sure there are a lot of folks who spent a lot of hours studying at the feet of Dr. Welsing over the years. You can go, share a word, network, learn some things. And she said, Sabrina Johnson, she told us they have audio, video segments of Dr. Welsing, so you'll get to hear some of her words as well. Make sure you go out and participate for folks that are in the region. Thanks again. Really, really appreciated you sharing some of your time and insight. And I also want to make sure I get in my gratitude again for the Black Child Journal copy that I got in the mail. I was really touched. Super thankful for that also. And just hope it has been worthy of your time to speak with us this evening, Sabrina.
Oh, absolutely. Much, much, much appreciation. Thank you, thank you, thank you to you for so much and for so long. You're doing great work. It is truly advancing in purity and accurately this work that Dr. Welsing had at the center, maintained at the center of her life for decades and decades and decades. So thank you. And Mr. Fuller, too, you've given a great platform for expanding this legacy. So much appreciation, and I'm always willing to be supportive in any way, so let me know how it can be. And look forward to the next time.
Absolutely. This is Sabrina Johnson visiting with us once again. We will definitely have her back on the program. And anyone, if you would like information, if you want to get a copy of the Winter 2016 edition of the Black Child Journal, which is a tribute to Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, the email again, blackchildjournal@gmail.com. Great articles, including our guest, Sabrina Johnson, in memory of Dr. Welsing. Thanks, everyone, for listening in. Hope it was worthy of your time as well. We'll be back. You can check the Black Talk Radio Network page or our Facebook page for any of the upcoming broadcasts. We'll certainly be here on Thursday for Workplace Racism and the Friday Book Club on Coretta Scott King's autobiography, also an alumnus at Antioch College. All normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Hope everyone is remaining codified. I will state again, I know the weather is warm. It'll be May 1st tomorrow. Get out, enjoy the sunshine. That does not mean relax on your codification. Racists, they do not take holidays from practicing white supremacy just because the weather is warm. Part of that should mean us remaining sober when we go out. I know Dr. Welsing would co-sign on that one. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. One of our listeners, she just texted or Facebooked me a message where there was this big pileup and all this other nastiness involved, alcohol at the core of it. I have seen no evidence that us being intoxicated, that's cigarettes, alcohol, cannabis, any other narcotics that they come up with, I've seen no evidence that us being under the influence of any of these substances is helping us to produce justice, eliminate the system of white supremacy. If anything, it seems to make it much easier for racists, white supremacists to dominate and abuse us. I think Dr. Welsing, Mr. Fuller, a lot of other folks that we say we have a lot of regard for, I think they would say, hey, let's try being sober and let our brain computer function at maximum efficiency to produce concepts and solutions to the problem, the system of white supremacy. With that, we would normally do our prayer, but I'm going to read Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, give her the final word before we conclude. And this is on the final page of the Black Child Journal Winter 2016 edition. Those who will to work for justice and who understand that work as their conscious responsibility will be found in all places and in all walks of life, at all levels of formal education and at all income levels. There are no class divisions nor language barriers for those who do this cosmic work. It is time for justice on the planet Earth. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.